Inception is a Firewire physical memory manipulation and hacking tool originally coded as a GPL replacement for WinLockPwn, made available by Adam Beaulieu, a.k.a. MetalStorm. WinLockPwn was quite stable.
Everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode 239. I am Patrick Gray. If you are wondering why there was no podcast last week, it's because I was at the AusCert Security Conference on the Gold Coast, where I published 17 podcasts into our secondary RSS feed, RB2. You can go to risky.biz/AusCert to view that content through your browser. You can go to /feeds to find the RB2 feeds and download that content with your podcatcher. And at the intro there, we heard Steve Gibson of the Security Now podcast proving conclusively that he is not a Risky Business listener. This week's show is brought to you by Adobe, and Adobe's Director of Product Security, Brad Arkin, will be along later on in the episode for this week's sponsor interview to talk all about Apple's decision to block vulnerable versions of Flash Player at the OS level in OS X. Brad will also discuss Adobe's controversial and subsequently reversed decision to not patch its CS5 suite of products against a code execution vulnerability. That's coming up later. This week's feature audio is an excerpt from an AusCert presentation I recorded last week. The talk by Brad Barker of the Halo Corporation discusses the Zeta drug cartel's use of technology and social media. Halo Corporation does everything from intelligence support to kidnap and ransom, real Hollywood stuff. So Barker does an interesting analysis of how civilian technology is altering methods of operation among, you know, cartels, terrorist organizations, things like that. So a discussion of civilian technology and how it affects the traditional battlefield. It's good stuff, and it's coming up after the news. Speaking of which, it's time now to take a look at this week's news headlines with our good friend Adam Boiler. Now, Adam, this first news item is one near and dear to my heart. There has been a massive political scandal here in Australia involving a Labor politician in a very precariously positioned minority government here, who has now, you know, become an independent because there's been an investigation into his past that has revealed that when he was a union boss, he was perhaps acquiring the services of ladies of the night using union-supplied credit cards, which, you know, when you're working to represent some of the poorest paid people in the country, not such a good look. Anyway, on Monday, he did us all a massive favour by dragging this whole sordid affair smack bang into our area of coverage by alleging, drumroll please, that his phone may have been cloned, and that's how the calls to those hookers appeared on my bill, Your Honour.
Which, you know, wow, that's pretty creative, you know, good skills there in the creative writing front. But yeah, what a crock of horse shit, right? Okay, let's say that we did clone his phone. Like, why would I phone hookers with his cloned phone?
Oh, no, he says it's all a setup from union rivals and stuff like that. And we do have to be careful what we say here, because there hasn't been an adverse finding against the guy in a court or anything like that. It's just there have been reports.
But no, from a technical perspective, right, actually cloning modern GSM phones, let alone, you know, UMTS, Kasumi, 3G, whatever phones, it's not really feasible without, you know, some very serious technical know-how. Like, you have to be Carsten Knoll, or you have to have $100,000 to go buy the law enforcement box. And you can't just buy those on the street corner. Well, at least certainly not in the West anyway. I mean, you know, maybe you can buy one in, you know, in North Africa or something. But yeah, certainly not so much here. It's just not a feasible story.
No, it doesn't really pass the sniff test, does it? But I mean, the early sort of Comp 128 algorithm supplied, you know, GSM SIM cards, they were clonable, but they got phased out in 2002. And these phone calls were alleged to have occurred in, like, you know, the mid-2000s. So yeah, Comp 128 V2 and V3, I think the algorithm has been extracted from the cards, but I don't think they've figured out how to extract key material yet. But Either way, like it's, yeah, theoretically kind of possible, but from a threat modeling perspective, it's funny. I wound up on Sydney Breakfast Radio with Adam Spencer talking about this. And I just said, look, from a threat modeling point of view, there are three letter agencies that are capable of doing this sort of thing, where those three letters aren't HSU, you know, for the Health Services Union.
Yeah, exactly, right? This is, yeah, that's just, it's very, very unlikely that your union rivals are cloning your SIM cards.
That's right. So verdict is, on the surface of it, that he may be talking out of his clacker. He didn't actually say that people had cloned his phone, just that it was a possibility. Oh, now here we go. This is the sort of stuff that makes us smile. This is, it's funny, I'd heard of this story already, but I remember when you IM'd me with a link to this yarn, just saying, Jesus wept. And I think it pretty much sums it up quite accurately. Adam, I'm not going to spoil the fun for you. Please explain to us our next story.
Right, so I mean, Yahoo clearly are a bunch of crackheads, right, who have lost the plot some many years ago. And they've decided to redeem themselves by, I don't know, inventing a web browser, because, you know, what we really need right now is another web browser. Okay, fair enough. Maybe they can innovate. Maybe they can deliver some kind of, you know, synergistic value-added web browsing technology. And they released this browser called Axis. And you can get it as a standalone browser for your mobile phone, or you can get it as like a plugin to stick in your Chrome or your Firefox. Or I don't know what the f***. Anyway, they shipped the package for Chrome, which is kind of like a compressed zip style kind of archive thing. And inside it, they put the private portion of their signing key.
Hey!
No. Look, I know public and private are, you know, they're pretty close, right? I mean, they've both got P's in them, you know, and an I, right? So, I mean, you know, fair enough mistake. But really, you shipped your private key that you signed it with in the I. Oh, what the f***?
Yeah, and the best thing about this, of course, is that someone already put code up on GitHub that allows you to, like, man in the middle the updating process for the plugin or the browser, right, so that it will just auto-run your payload on that machine because, yeah, hey, it's got a valid signature. To their credit, though, I think they've actually fixed this. They had Google yank the key and, like, you know, all of that, and there's been revocation and all sorts of faffing about, but I think they've actually moved to fix this up. Interestingly enough, this bug was found by a guy, Nick Kabrilovich, or Kabrilovic. This is a dude who I actually met at San Francisco Airport like 6 years ago. His name stuck out because it's quite, you know, it's quite an unusual name. And I just, I'd got off a flight. I was going to some, I think it was actually a Yahoo junket, now that I think about it. I went outside and, you know, bought a cigarette off the guy. And we just got chatting, and he was doing all sorts of startups and stuff. But he's more of a developer type than a security guy. Well, back then anyway. But, you know, nice spot, Nick.
Yeah, it was definitely a very good spot. Like, I mean, I would sit there and look at that and go like, nah, surely not. And then have to go and read, you know, 300 pages of docs to make sure that I was actually right and this really was their actual signing key just hanging about in there. But yeah, very, very funny stuff and way to convince the world that Yahoo is back on its game.
Yeah, good one, guys. Maybe you should stick to executives that do have real computer science degrees, you know. Now, just briefly, Adam, we've been covering this DNS changer thing over the last sort of couple of months, the saga that is. Google has actually come up with a novel idea to, you know, address the problem pretty practically and sort of let people know that they've been infected so that they can, you know, change their DNS settings back so that when the US government, you know, pulls the pin on those, or the courts or whoever pull the pin on those DNS boxes, those users won't be marooned.
Yeah, so from a technical perspective, it seems like quite a cunning and, you know, clever solution. So, you know, good on them for that. The downsides, of course, are the traditional, you know, reasons that we've, you know, kind of avoided doing this sort of thing in the past, which is if you start training people that Google's going to save them and tell them what to do, then, you know, people will start spoofing those alerts and instructing people to install DNS changing malware instead or something.
Yeah,
it's a good idea.
You know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
So. Well, exactly. And I mean, it assumes that the machines that are infected with this stuff are actually being used by humans, right? We don't really take into account the machines that are, you know, not actually interactively operated, like control systems and, you know, embedded systems that may have been infected.
Yeah, but I mean, this is going to take care of a large proportion, you would think, of the user population. So I think it's a net positive. Now, Telstra has just reissued, Australia's largest telco, Telstra has reissued 35,000 passwords for its Game Arena website after it lost control of its database. And fortunately, though, little hat tip to Telstra, the passwords were actually encrypted. So they got some hashes.
Well, that's good. Unfortunately, cracking hashes is not so difficult these days. But yeah, you know, I'm sure 35,000 passwords is merely the tip of the iceberg. But good on them for spotting it and doing something.
Well, and they forced a system-wide password reset. So, you know, bad Telstra for getting owned, good Telstra for actually responding, right?
Yeah, I guess I'll give you that.
Excellent. Now, here's an interesting piece focusing on Australian law. Darren Pawley wrote this one up for Secure Computing Magazine here in Australia. There's a new Privacy Act proposed. Currently in Australia, like if you've found to have been negligent in handling personal information, the Privacy Commissioner can basically have an adverse finding, fine you $200 and tell you you're very naughty. Under proposed changes to the Privacy Act, we're talking about fines of up to $1.1 million.
Yeah, and I think this is a really good thing. And the Privacy Commissioner over here in New Zealand has been arguing to have, you know, kind of more sticks to go with, you know, the stern language. And this is a good thing. Like, hopefully this will actually end up in law and you will have some stick to actually beat people with. And, you know, $1 million is a reasonable amount of money, that's for sure.
Yeah, the Australian Direct Marketing Association is just totally flipping out over this. It's hilarious.
But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a helpful tool. You know, bad publicity is good, right? That's really the only thing they've got at the moment.
Yeah.
But actual real money would make a difference, hopefully.
Yeah, totally. I mean, people would start taking compliance a little bit more seriously, I would think. Now, oh my God, this is a doozy. This is a little bit odd, but there was no show last week, so I figure we just have to cover this. The ZTE Score M phone, it's an Android Gingerbread phone. Someone found an awful root back door in the thing, and you know, published details of that on Pastebin, the new full disclosure. But yeah, I mean, it's total, like, you know, you enter in a factory supplied password, bang, root shell.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. It's a like some kind of SUID binary, as you say. It takes a hard-coded password and gives you a root shell. Now, obviously, this is only any use if you're already running code on the device. I'm not 100% clear, given that I don't particularly understand the Android security model, as to whether like any random app can execute a binary on disk and therefore get root, or whether it has to have some permissions to be able to execute things. But yes, essentially, it does appear that if you have any sort of access to an Android phone with this, you know, from ZTE with this particular software, then yes, you can trivially get root, which is a bad thing. And they're not attributing this to anything other than, you know, kind of incompetence.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, crazy Chinese phone backdoors, although maybe that's what they want us to think.
Oh, there you go. Counter, 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 counter.
Yeah, always get out the Trace Buster Buster.
That's right. Well, speaking of spooky news, the NSA is actually teaming up with universities in the United States to help train students, you know, who might be gifted in certain arts for basically, you know, ops, for like, you know, offensive cyber ops.
Now, this sounded to me like a good idea, and I was reading through the article and thinking, yeah, this is great. I mean, obviously, education is something that is very important. We need more people in InfoSec. We certainly need more people in government InfoSec, where the pay is shit. And it seemed like a great idea. And then I got down to the paragraph that says, as a quote from a senior NSA official, we're not asking them to teach kids how to break into systems. We're not asking them to teach that. A lot of them have said they wouldn't teach that. And that's when I went, so what are you going to teach them then? Like all the things that haven't worked so far? If you don't know how to break things, you're really not going to know how to defend them, guys.
No, come on, Adam. That's a PR line. That is a dead set PR line, because he's saying, oh, we're just asking them to teach the hardcore fundamental science that we need students to have when they come to work here, which is exploitation and crypto and all of that stuff. I mean, it's just, that's a PR line.
Okay, sure. I would like to believe that, yes.
Yeah, look, I think it is. And look, this story dovetails with our next story pretty nicely, which comes to us via threat post. It's been around the place. But Northrop Grumman, the defense contractor, the baby killers, they are hiring software engineers for offensive cyberspace operations. This has become an established, legitimate skill set that is being actively recruited by the private defense sector and government. So it's no real surprise that the NSA is teaming up with the education sector to try to develop those skills.
Yeah, and I'd like to contrast what the NSA is, you know, according to their PR line, attempting to get people to learn, like the hard science, and what Northrop Grumman are listing in their job advertisement,
which is Metasploit,
required skills, which is Metasploit and Google Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I'm seeing a little bit of a contrast here.
Oh, I don't know, you know, like it's, you know.
Oh, come on. You're telling me that Metasploit and Google Earth are state-of-the-art for offensive cyber operations?
No, I'm not saying it's state-of-the-art, but I figure, you know, someone who's going to know what exploitation is and maybe, you know, do a bit. I mean, they're going to know how to write a Metasploit module, you know?
I mean, seriously, you're going to list things like that in the job ad, really, Metasploit. It's just embarrassing. It's embarrassing.
Okay, well, I'm sure maybe someone from Northrop will write out so that you can write them a better JD.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Now, back in Australia now, and there was a bit of an event, I think it was last year actually, where an employee of Australia's government broadcaster had allegedly loaded some software onto a server to mine bitcoins. And at the time, I think we actually covered it. And at the time, we thought that they were just using the server's processing power, you know, to try to mine bitcoins. But as it turns out, this guy had actually published JavaScript. This is according to a Fairfax report, had published JavaScript into like ABC pages that would get visitors to those sites to do the mining. Now, if that's true, I mean, apparently this guy is just, there's been a couple of questions on notice in the Australian Senate about this. And they said, yep, the guy was disciplined. He's had his access revoked, blah, blah, blah. If he had actually done that, loaded up JavaScript that got visitors to mine for bitcoins, and I can't say one way or another if that is fact, but if that is the fact, that guy should lose his job.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if for no other reason than mining bitcoins with JavaScript, like how fast do you think that's going to go?
Yeah,
right?
You're going to
need like a million boxes, right? Just go buy a $25 ATI video card and it'll go faster. Like he should be fired for just being dumb.
Dereliction
of duty or whatever the f***.
Yeah. But apparently the ABC detected the code like within 30 minutes.
And probably because the load was 100% on everybody.
Yeah, well, maybe a few calls to the help desk. But either way, geez, man, that's pretty bad. I don't know what he's got on his boss to actually have kept his job, but there you go. Oh, now quickly, I just wanted to mention this next piece, which is which says that some APT-style actors are still using flash bugs that are months old, which I thought was quite interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if you've got a technology and it works, then you're going to keep on using it. There's got to be people you can own with three-month-old bugs.
Mm.
I mean, you read about people getting owned in all sorts of, you know, relatively niche areas that aren't going to have IT support. You know, the story about Amnesty International or, you know, Chinese, you know, political activists. Like, these people don't have sophisticated IT support operations with, you know, WSUS boxes patching all their shits all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, three-month-old exploits, you know, are absolutely going to work against, you know, some of those sort of second-tier targets, I guess.
Well, we are talking about a bug that was patched on February 15, so it looks like there might actually be some benefit to Adobe bringing in a silent updater for Flash. So, you know.
Yes, well, I think we discussed that they should have got a biscuit for that. And
yes.
Then we took it away again, didn't we?
Yes, well, you'll actually hear in this week's sponsor interview that Brad Arkin has become somewhat protective of his biscuits, which is quite funny. Anyway, now Global Payments, which was the most recent credit card processing you know, operator to get popped, and they had about 7 million cards stolen. It turns out that they were actually owned up well before when they thought they were. It looks like they had actually been owned as early as January 2011. Not June, which is previously what we thought.
Yeah, so I mean, it looks like the data does suggest that that was the case. And, you know, on one hand, you want to say, well, I mean, clearly they were trying to cover it up and make it sound less bad. But on the other hand, you know, having been involved in incident response, right, it is very hard to get a good timeline, and especially when you don't want to hear how bad it is. So, and I have some sympathy for them. Like, maybe it is going to take them, or has taken them 6 months to figure out the full extent. And then it is hard to come out and say, well, actually, we were wrong before. So, you know, I have a small amount of sympathy for the forensics guys. But, yeah, it doesn't look good for them at all.
No. Owned sideways. Now, just quickly, the White House security czar, silly title, that, isn't it? Howard Schmidt, who has a background in Air Force, I think, and then he was with Microsoft for a long time and then eBay. He's retiring from the White House. Now, it was interesting, too, because at the time that he took the job, there'd been a bunch of executives, high-profile sort of vendor executives who'd been approached for it. And, you know, people sort of snidely said that Howard took the job because, you know, he was the only one who'd take it and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's actually turned out that he did some really good policy work there. And I think he actually won a lot of respect for that. And now he's stepping down. So I think really at the end of the day, he won a lot of respect for that. Also retiring from his current position is Rob Milan, who is the founder and CTO of Arbor Networks. I mean, he wrote a lot of the code in the products. He is... You know, I mean, he would be at home at KiwiCon having the most, you know, or RuxCon having the most technical discussions with anyone. He's a real hacker, a very, very, very smart guy. And it'll be interesting to see how Arbor fare without him. And he wrote a fantastic blog post announcing his departure from the company after 12 years. It was very good stuff. Now, this is another one that makes us laugh, makes us cry a little bit. A botmaster has been outed when some dude just like decided to own up his CNC. And I love it that the guy's just claimed it. He's like, yeah, I hacked the shit out of this dude, you know, which is becoming more and more common. These sort of vigilante actions, people are being more open about the fact that they're actually exploiting malware writers and stuff. But anyway, so this researcher owned the shit out of a CNC and basically identified this guy by name. He totally doxed him.
Yeah, it was awesome. He found a bug in the command and control software, got SQL, blind SQL injection, apparently, into the command and control. From there, managed to pop a shell on the developer's box, the guy who ran the botnet's box, and then had to rummage around, found his Facebook account, found all his details, and yeah, doxed the shit out of him, which
it's pretty good lulz. Funny.
Yeah, yeah, that is. That's good old-fashioned lulz. And as you say, like, you can get away with it, because what are you going to do? Phone the police?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no, you hacked a criminal. Well, ooh. You know, and okay, yes, I wouldn't advocate that people go ahead and do that because
yes,
I'm going to ask some risks. Well, not on public radio. perhaps on the internet. Hang on, this is on the internet. So maybe
this is on the internet. So we're uncensored. Well, I beep, but you know.
Beepity beep. Yes, you should all go hack all of the botnets all the time.
There you go.
That is my advice to you.
Adam Boileau, inciting crime. And on that note, Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. It's been good to chat to you again, mate, and we'll pick it up again next week.
I'll talk to you then, Pat.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Thank you, Adam. Okay, so moving on now to this week's feature audio, which is a recording of a presentation at OSCERT, which was done by Brad Barker, the president and founder of the Halo Corporation, a California-based company founded by former Special Operations National Security and Intelligence personnel. These guys do all sorts of interesting, spooky, spooky stuff. They have an operations unit, a science and tech unit, and a training unit. And they do stuff like kidnap and ransom consulting. And you'll hear a bit about that in the excerpt. Brad's talk was titled Force Multipliers on the Modern Battle Space. And essentially, it takes a look at how the civilian internet and social media is changing adversary tactics. Networked communications have been available to militaries for decades. It is technology that has provided conventional militaries with a significant edge when at war. When you're collecting data from your troops on the ground and analyzing it, you can do stuff like identify and replicate successful methods of operation. Now, in this talk, Brad argues that the bad guys, whether they're terrorists, drug cartels, whatever, from an adversary analysis point of view, it's kind of irrelevant to his talk. He argues they're now applying the same sorts of principles as militaries do because they have access to network technology, or as he calls it, tactical cloud computing. Now, there's a few assertions in here that I disagree with, but on the whole, I think this is a very compelling analysis of modern networked technology and social media from the perspective of someone who sees this stuff through a sort of more military and intelligence prism. So I'll drop you in here when he starts talking about the notorious Mexican drug cartel, the Zetas. Enjoy.
The Zeta drug cartel is, in my view, the most sophisticated and the most brutal organized crime syndicate in history, period. What they do to people, how they torture them, and what they do to elicit information and prove their point is terrorism. It's what I call a weapon of mass effect. They don't have weapons of mass destruction in the traditional sense, but the way that they're killing people, they're using media to get their word out. It's media that's the payload. So the way we look at that, if you look at a recent Mexican cartel raid, if you look at these weapons, automatic weapons that look like they're only to be fortified to a paramilitary group funded by a government. Communications, encrypted communications on the RF spectrum, automatic weapons, fragmentation grenades, RPGs, Barrett 50 caliber armor-piercing machine guns, fragmentation there, and of course the uniforms. They self-identify. NIJ, National Institute of Justice, bullet-resistant vehicles, armored vehicles. That's the traditional battle space that we would think a cartel would operate in. Social media is the new battle space. The way that social media has sort of evolved over the last, I'd say, 5 years, but for the most part, This is not a new concept. Just being able to do point-to-point or point-to-multipoint communication is not a new thing. It started way back in the day in houses of worship and how people prayed. That was sort of the town center. Now the town center and how people get their information is usually they're looking at the world through a window that looks like a monitor. And now with wireless communication, it's something that fits in your pocket. So if the battle space is cyberspace and the weapon system is social media, which I'll demonstrate here in a second, and the IP addresses are our gateway into the battle space, then we carry our vulnerabilities with us. Because I would challenge you to get any new 4G, 3G phone that doesn't already have a GPS in it, one or more cameras, and all kinds of automation that's already in the firmware that is going to be telling people where you are, or gear things up, lock it and load it so that when you push certain apps, it's going to tell people where you are. Now, this is done for convenience, so that you can share information. But this is the huge exploit that very unlikely characters like mature metropolitan street gangs, Mexican drug cartels, organized crime syndicates, they're all now getting switched on. They're all getting tech savvy, and they are already occupying real estate in cyberspace. One specific incident that just happened this December, a cartel just south of San Diego called La Familia has a new method of operation that is emerging where they take teenagers. Okay, obviously, they really like teenagers because at the age of 18, you can be tried as an adult. If you get busted as a teenager, your crime can be pled down. So these guys go up through the ranks in the cartels rather quickly. So these teenagers are brought illegally into the United States, and they are put into homes of adults as custodial guardians. These custodial guardians put them into the affluent, high net worth private schools, and the kids very patiently attend class, get good grades, join sports teams, socialize, get popular. They get on Facebook. They friend everybody. I like you. I like you. I like you. Then La Familia shot callers down in Mexico log on to the Facebook page, and they've got a tapestry of images, a tapestry of intel. Now, typically, in human intelligence, operators and people in the positions of trust in the intelligence community would learn over decades fieldcraft and tradecraft on how to elicit this information and get intel on their targets. Well, now, 25% of the population of the planet has a social media profile of some kind. So now the challenge for those that plan to do us harm is triaging what is the white noise and what is the actionable intelligence that can be exploited. So in this scenario, the cartels were logging on to the Facebook pages and looking at all of these targets for human trafficking. And they said, bring me her, and bring me her. And they're doing this remotely. They're doing this from a foreign country. They're doing it with their agents in the U.S., and they're using Facebook to automate their process of target selection. They look for three things, what that we call the three Vs. How visible are you, how valuable are you, and how vulnerable are you? And they can do this with a veil of anonymity and a low risk of being found out because of the geography and because it's also just a kid. So in one such instance, a 15-year-old girl who was the daughter of a well-known San Diego professional athlete went to a party. One thing led to another through the processes of elicitation, got in the car. It's very easy to be in a foreign country in minutes when you live in San Diego. So in a joint operation between the Halo Corporation, U.S. Marshals, Mexican intelligence, we were able to tag, track, and locate the ransom demands that were coming to the family through social media. So in a blend of human intelligence and signal intelligence, we were able to find out where these people lived. And in less than a week, we were able to, in collaboration with Mexican government, bring her back and reunite her with the families. So this issue is significant because this is a new method of operation. It's a new exploit. And yes, there are so folks that speculated that this was possible, but now having it happen in a way that we can point to and break down the method of operation so we can start developing curriculum out of it, so we can start training in the schools, training law enforcement. The challenge if you're the good guy, is those that are in policy, those that have access to budgets, those that have procurement authority, are a little salt and pepper around the temples, they're a little older, and they don't really understand this whole social media thing. And they don't know that they've entered the battle space. They don't know that the battle space has enveloped them. Because this Facebook thing is not going away anytime soon, gang. In 10 years, it has become, in a couple weeks, it's going to be the most profitable company in history. And Zuckerberg's going to be the richest man in the world. No, not likely to go away. Likely to get copied. Likely for that method of operation to be exported. And likely for this method of operation of automating the process of target selection using social media in cyberspace is going to be copied for any kind of crime. This is just one. This is where the enemy resides. This is where they're planning their crimes. All their techniques and tactics and procedures that have existed historically now have a cyber equivalent, now have a manifestation in cyberspace where that same method of operation can be automated, and now it's global. I don't think I've been to a brief this week where Anonymous wasn't mentioned, so I don't want to buck the system. We've got a good trend going. So we talked about the Zetas a moment ago. There was a specific incident which, in my view, is another significant watershed day in how this method of operation is evolving over time, where the concept of crowdsourcing is being utilized in Mexico when citizens see crimes occurring by cartels and other organized crime syndicates, and the concept of if you see something, say something, now has a cyber equivalent. They see something going down, they're going to take a picture of it with their phone. They're going to tweet it. They're going to blog it. They're going to put it onto blogs like Blog del Narco or Narco Blog, and they're going to tell people in the area that this is happening. And it's real-time, situational awareness, instantaneous, and you don't have to wait for the news crew and pictures at 11. It's now, and it's coming to your phone. It's kind of cool. Law enforcement in Mexico has gotten sweet on this idea, and they're understanding that the citizens are on patrol because Mexico is living in fear. They are existing in a stranglehold from these cartels. So they're pushing this stuff out. And law enforcement is starting to use it and identify, interdict, and apprehend senior cartel members because of social media. On one such event, one of the bloggers was taken by the Zeta drug cartel. And it just so happens that in a stroke of bad luck, they just happened to have an affiliation with Anonymous. Anonymous got on YouTube and said, okay, Zetas, we understand that you guys are doing this stuff. We know who you are. We've hacked your hard drives. We know which ones of you are law enforcement, which ones of your cartel are politicians, and which ones are on the take, and we're going to expose you all until you pack up and go home. The Zetas responded in Blog del Narco and in Facebook, not on YouTube, as a reply to this slap in the face and basically being called out by Anonymous. And the final analysis, after going back and forth in social media and basically having a bit of a war of words, they said, for every person that you out, we're going to kill 10 people. And so that went back and forth and dissolved, and eventually Anonymous, hacktivist group, very powerful, basically bailed on the Operation Zeta. And now Zetas, unfortunately, months ago, were a very good cartel and battling the Sinaloa for supremacy in Mexico, went up against the most sophisticated hacktivist group in the world and prevailed. Sent a very serious message to law enforcement in the region that these guys are standing virtually uncontested. So crowdsourcing continued. The Zetas got pretty confident that now that they've sent Anonymous packing, they can continue business as usual. Well, the crowdsourcing began, and then they started getting more tech savvy and outsourcing some training, and they learned how to tag, track, locate, and eliminate the people that were blogging the cartel's activities because it was choking off their revenue streams. Their senior leadership was getting rolled up by law enforcement. They had to put an end to it. So how did they do it? The same old way they have been, by killing people in a public way, torturing them, and then writing notes to the media in their own blood that this is what happens to you if you blog about the Zetas. So the issue here, again, another watershed day in how this method of operation is propagating. Typically, the Zeta drug cartels would be a point-and-shoot mentality. But now you throw technology in to, again, one of the most brutal organized crime syndicates in history. You give them and empower them with technology, and now it's not just point and shoot, it's point and click in order to kill people. This is new. And now that genie's out of the bottle, it's not going back in. And so if you follow these issues, not only in Mexico, but I'm sure you're going to see another manifestation of something like this somewhere else in the world, where this method of operation is going to be copied, customized, and come soon to a theater near you. This is in cyberspace, the new battleground. This is using social media to deliver the payload. And there are consequences, and there is a body count. Now that I've told you that the sky is falling, and there is no Santa, and your parents really don't like you, it's not just all doom and gloom. There is some hope. In the United States, we're starting to see a new trend, not as fast as I'd like, but it is starting to happen. People are starting to get it. There are some younger law enforcement and intelligence folks that are combating these threats that are starting to get switched on as well. Because they're younger people, they get it. They grew up in a net-centric environment, so this isn't alien to them. Like it is the senior policy people and the people that might fund training like this, they just don't understand it. The younger agents do. So now we're starting to see police blogs. We're starting to see YouTube channels for specific police departments and agencies that want to address the population on specific things that they deem appropriate. You're starting to get a collaborative data exchange of intel from the street to law enforcement that they are acting on much faster than they ever have historically when they've been using their in-car radios. Because just the cadence of communication between the people that dial 911 in the United States, back to command, to dispatch, to send rollers out there to get real live situational awareness of, is the kitten still in the tree? Is the house really burning down? This is all happening much, much faster now. That OODA loop that we call for observing, orienting, deciding, and acting, that loop, which was much larger, is now getting much, much smaller because of the use of social media by law enforcement. This is encouraging. This is a good thing. We're not where we need to be yet, but this is starting to catch on. Right now in the United States, there are over 700 agencies that have active Twitter accounts. So they're getting data back and forth, and they're acting on it. And they are using that to catch the bad guys. So they're starting, reluctantly, to enter and understand the space that they're operating in. All right? Thank you all very much. I appreciate your time.
That was an excerpt from Brad Barker's OSCERT presentation that he did last week at the OSCERT conference on the Gold Coast. Now, if you'd like to hear all of the Risky Business coverage from OSCERT, do point your browser towards risky.biz/OSCERT or subscribe to the RB2 RSS feed. You can find it in the iTunes Music Store by searching for RB2. And as I said earlier, I published 17 podcasts in that feed from last week's conference. And I would not have been able to do that without the stellar work of Anthony Lawrence, the Risky Business sound recordist for this year's event. He did a great job. So, Ant, if you're listening, mate, big thanks for your great effort throughout the con. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Brad Arkin, the Director of Product Security with Adobe. I interviewed Brad earlier in the week about a few things. There are some interesting community building exercises taking place among large software developers. He's going to talk about that. We also chatted about Adobe's controversial decision to leave a very serious bug in its CS5 suite unpatched. Now, they were only intending to fix it in the next release, CS6, which of course is a paid upgrade. So the internet got hysterical, the Twitterverse exploded, and Adobe wound up reversing its decision. So he'll fill us in with his perspective on that and the behind the scenes, what happened. But the first thing I wanted to know is what Brad thought about Apple's decision to block old versions of Flash Player in its OS X operating system. Here he is.
I think that it's a good thing that they did. And I wrote up a blog post and published it the same day that they shipped the update, because the most important thing for users is to stay up to date. And if you've got really out of date software, then that is a potential risk. And so what they did was, is in the past, Apple has shipped versions of Flash Player through their software update mechanism. And then they don't do that anymore. And so the last version that they had shipped was, 10 dot something, a couple years ago. And so what they did with this update was they took anyone who still had that old version of Flash Player installed, they disabled it by moving it to a folder that had a name like disabled plugins or something like that. So it's still there. So if someone needed it for some reason, they can go get it back. And then they also told users, if you want Flash Player, here's where to get the latest version. From our perspective, this is a encouraging best practice, helping people to stay up to date. And if you've got something that's old and you're not using it, then if you're not using it, that's great. Let's turn it off, reduce attack surface. And if you are using it, let's get you on the latest version. So it's just security goodness in my mind.
Mm. And of course, what I like about this is the current version of Flash does silent security patches. So that's pretty much problem solved in terms of keeping those users up to date.
Yeah, we hope so. And the background updater is something that we've used twice now. One was for a non-security update and the other one was for a security update. And based on the bandwidth bills, we think it's working very well.
In breaking news, Adobe sent bankrupt. Plug in some more routers. Now, of course, in some other news relating to patching vulnerabilities, you guys were at the center of some pretty significant controversy recently when you decided to not patch Adobe CS5 and instead roll the fix into CS6, which is, of course, a paid upgrade. The Twitterverse exploded. There was much wailing and gnashing of teeth. People were essentially saying that you guys were charging for an upgrade. Then the decision was reversed. Can you just walk us through what happened, Brad?
Yeah, sure. And proactively here, I went out and bought a dozen cookies earlier today. So in case you guys try to take my biscuits away. So basically, whenever bugs come in, we have a process where we go through and triage them. And some bugs deem a immediate 0-day urgent release. Other bugs we fold into the next downstream release. And that's what we did for these bugs here. And so the next downstream release happened to be CS6. And when we looked at the bugs and the products that were impacted, we didn't deem that they required a standalone dot release for the existing versions because we labeled them a priority 3 real world. We don't really think that this is something that's putting the users at risk, and we're always trying to balance convenience for our users and the annoyance and headache of applying updates against the benefit and value that it provides to the users. And so the plan was that we would fold those security updates into the next downstream release for the older versions. But in the meantime, if you're really hung up on it, you can go get CS6. And there's a lot of customer feedback. We listened to it. And so we had shipped the bulletin describing the vulnerabilities on Tuesday. I think it was May 4th. And then on Friday, we updated that bulletin. And I think we sent a piece of blog post saying we're now planning to ship standalone dot releases to fix these vulnerabilities in the impacted products, for the CS5, CS5.5 versions as well. And so that was something where we're always trying to balance, inconvenience of applying a patch against the need for a patch. And in this case,
hang on. Isn't it yep. always going to be better to offer your users the option to apply a patch? I mean, it's one thing to say, look, we don't want to force them to go through this complicated upgrade process with fragile installs of complicated software, but you've at least got to offer them an option, don't you?
Well, apparently we do. That was the customer feedback. But
the internet says yes.
Right, yeah. So the internet decides that we need to do that from now on. And so, we'll factor that in for our decision-making process in the future. Creative Suite user base now wants the security updates, and we heard it, so we're going to do that, and we're doing that for these bugs, and in the future we'll keep doing it.
What occurred to me too is that okay, and you've said to me too that people attacking Photoshop, it doesn't really happen, but if there's proof of concept code out there for a pretty easy to trigger bug, there's POC code out there, and the vendor's not going to patch it, you would think that because the bug is perennial, then people would move to exploit it. It's almost like by the very nature of the publicity around the decision, it sort of made the decision unworkable. Do you know what I mean? Like it would have been a Metasploit module within like 10 minutes.
Yeah. So, I understand the reasoning behind that, but the inputs that we had to the decision was that we've never, ever heard of a single user of any of these products being targeted for attack in any way. And then your example, Metasploit module, I'm not sure that there is one for those bugs yet. I know that.
Well, you're patching it now, so there's no point. That's kind of where I'm coming from. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you know that there's going to be a bug that's perennial, it's always there, you're going to put that in your pen testing toolkit.
I mean, maybe your pen testing toolkit, but if you're a real world bad guy, I honestly believe there's easier and better ways to attack that user than through a an unfamiliar product from a security perspective. You know, there's lots of more familiar attack methods available. So, but this is the thing, like, we don't know, it's never happened, we're shipping the updates, so, you know, it's unlearned. The internet says yes.
The internet took your biscuits away, and now you have biscuits again. So
right.
we are happy on behalf of Risky Business to return your biscuits following your decision to update CS5. Now, I understand you've been quite busy with a couple of events, which is interesting. You know, I mean, I spend a lot of time at events which are, mostly focused on the offensive side, I guess. And then you've got events like OSCERT, which are a bit of a blend between the two. But you're involved in a few consortiums of like-minded individuals such as yourself who work for large software vendors. You guys have had a bit of a shindig.
Yeah, so a couple of things happened last week. So the first one was on Monday. Adobe is a member of a group called Safecode, which has members like Microsoft, Nokia, SAP, Symantec, Siemens is the most recent member, EMC, Juniper Networks. Yeah. Well, so, and to be honest, you know, Adobe joined in summer of 2009, and it's a group of big companies with very large development organizations that are serious about addressing software security. And we come from different spots on the maturity curve for doing software security. And so in my mind, like, when I joined Adobe, when I took the decision to sign up in summer 2009, we weren't anywhere near as mature as we are today around software security. But I wanted to get in the room with my peers who are doing it and have been doing it for a number of years, so that we could, you know, trade tips and tactics and
yeah,
what
look,
works
it makes
for you,
sense. Yeah, it
know?
Does.
Yeah, and so on Monday last week, we hosted an event in Washington D.C. and we invited a bunch of U.S. government types to come, and we did a couple panels talking about, you know, what works in secure software development, and also as a buyer of software, what should you look for in a development organization? You know, how do you kick the tires of a vendor from a security perspective? And it was pretty interesting. Yeah, so we had some good conversations there. And then
what's the verdict? I mean, how do you kick the tires? Because that's a problem that affects a lot of the enterprise listeners that tune into this podcast.
Unfortunately, there's no really well accepted seal of approval where you can just say, oh, you know, just because something's common criteria certified, for example, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be any harder to attack.
Yeah, it's crypto and might be okay, but you can own it sideways with a, you know, 90s style buffer overflow.
Yeah. And so there's no, you know, underwriter's laboratory equivalent for software today. And so what we were, and these are, you know, government buyers, very big procurement shops. And so they have the time and energy to devote to really assessing their vendor universe and making good decisions on this. And we were saying things like, you know, there's the quick and dirty buyer's guide to make sure that your vendor cares about security. So you go to companyname.com/security. Does it exist? Do they have a response process? If you send an email to secure@, do you get a response? You know, there's a lot of things that are sort of indicators or characteristics of an organization that cares about security. And it doesn't mean that every product is necessarily going to be up to your standards. But if they have no response process, there's never been a CV against their product, you don't know how they would perform in a zero-day situation, then you want to drill down on that. And
you want to find some OA, drop it on full disk and see how they respond.
Yeah. And if, you know, for some vendors, there's a lot of historical data on what that response looks like. And then for other vendors, you just don't know. And so if it's not there, it doesn't mean they're not prepared. It's just worth asking. And if you're the U.S. government, you spend enough on software that you can expect answers to those questions. So we were talking about that. And then the reason we hosted it in D.C. on Monday is because on Tuesday and Wednesday, there is an event, the first annual Security Development Conference. And so this was an event that Microsoft sponsored, and then Adobe and Cisco were also sponsors. And the, you know, there's a ton of security conferences out there. There's very few events that are really focused at the software security defenders and the builders. So there's plenty of pen test conference, offensive security research conference, and then, like you were mentioning, antivirus or network defense audiences. But people who are responsible for software security within organizations that produce software, and they're not necessarily firewall buyers, you know, but they're really just focused on how do you build security into the software. That's a niche that's not really being addressed. And so this conference was an attempt to bring those people together. And so if you think,
I think that's actually great, because that's, you know, that's often been a criticism of anyone who's been in the InfoSec space for a long enough period of time, is it's all very well and good for people like, you know, our good friend Adam Boileau to sit around waxing his beard and chortling to himself over getting root. But there isn't a scene for the defenders, is there? There's no scene, no circuit really for secure software developers.
Yeah, and this is something, you know, OWASP has some threads of defense in there, but it's a lot of, there's a whole lot of people in there that are doing.
Yeah,
you know,
check out my latest cross-site request forgery technique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then the two big communities are, so there's Safecode, which is a small group of very big software builders who care about security. There's 8 of us right now. And then there's a few more who may join, but you know, that's not a really big club. And then there's BSIMM, which is a measure, you know, building security and maturity model, BSIMM. And that's a collection of measurements of organizations that care about security. And then they do annual get togethers. And so that's a little bit of a community that's forming, but it's really just getting started. And so this Microsoft sponsored conference last week was another attempt at community building and bringing together people who want to learn, people that want to share, you know, that kind of crowd. And we were all, one thing that was awesome was that it's the first conference I've been to where I didn't get a single vendor sales pitch. So there's no, you know, consulting shops or things like that. It's just people like me who work with development organizations trying to make things better. And so we got to trade notes, talked about what worked, what doesn't. And it was really good. So we had a few presentations that we participated in. We got to sit in a bunch. And they had some big name speakers too. So they had General Hayden, his former NSA and CIA director. Richard Cyberwar Clark was there. He gave a talk. You know, and a few other big names and then a lot of little names. So,
well, it sounds,
it's good. Yeah.
Sounds very good. And we hope that community building actually works well, because I think we could use a community focused on secure development at large vendors. I think that's a worthy aim. Brad Arkin, we are out of time. It is a pleasure to chat to you as always, and we'll chat to you again soon.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Brad Arkin of our sponsor Adobe there with this week's sponsor interview. And big thanks to Adobe for its support of the Risky Business Podcast and independent InfoSec Media. Thanks again. We really appreciate the support. And that is it for this week's show. You can find me on Twitter at Risky Business, one word. And I'm playing this week's track for our American friends. The singer is actually American, but he moved to Australia with his family when he was 11 years old. His name is John Butler, and he put out his first album in 1998. And he's really been going from strength to strength ever since. Now, if anything, I prefer his later stuff, which this is. This track is from the mid-2000s, and it's called Something's Gotta Give. Now, it's essentially a protest song that isn't political, and that's a trick too many bands and musicians these days just don't pull off. I mean, the Beatles said, they did it brilliantly, they said, "We don't like war." Whereas Bono, you know, you get the impression he's angling to become the next Secretary General of the United Nations. You know, he's like a policy wonk pop star. It's really weird. So this John Butler Trio track is a return to the protest music of old. And, you know, I wish there was more music written along these lines. You can get it on iTunes. And until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
In my gut that I get of late, when I think about these cats running the world with hate, I say something got to give. Got the whole world fighting for the Texas tea. Got a little for you, I got a little for me, but the kettle's leaking like a sieve. Now there's a puddle on the floor, there's a puddle. puddle in the sky. The kettle's leaking so much, the man is burning my eyes, yeah. Can't we just throw that damn pot out? And on the subject of throwing stuff away, I know some deaf men who can't hear a word we say. No matter, no matter how loud we do shout. And I say, something gotta give right now. Something gotta give right now for you. Something gotta give right now, man. But something gotta give right now. The newspaper just yesterday got the headlines reading God bless the USA, and I thought God bless everyone. God bless the people in New York when they were attacked. God bless the children being bombed there in Iraq. God bless the goddamn junkie with the monkey on his back. God bless everybody under the sun. Because the road ahead of land if we don't got love, you can drive a pay a day to the guy above. But eventually the only guarantee because without love, you know there ain't no life. You can duplicate and bottle it up for you like, but it doesn't mean we're gonna get another try. I get another try, but something gotta give right now. Something gotta give right now.